Hi, I'm Mel Pickup, Chief Executive of Bradford Teaching Hospitals, and welcome to this month's episode of our podcast series, where I'm sitting down with colleagues and partners from across the Trust and the wider community to find out more about them and their contributions to the health and the well-being of the people here in Bradford. Today, we're exploring the vital and often misunderstood field of palliative care, discussing its importance, challenges, and the innovative research being conducted to improve end-of-life care. So I am thrilled to be joined by two distinguished guests who bring a wealth of experience and insight into this essential area of healthcare. First, we have Victoria Alley, the lead nurse for palliative care. Victoria, it's great to have you with us. And joining Victoria is Jamila Hussain, a consultant in palliative medicine and senior research fellow. Welcome, Jamila. We're going to be delving into what palliative care truly means, addressing some common misconceptions and discussing the impactful work being done right here in Bradford to ensure equitable and compassionate care for all. Can I start, Victoria, with you? Could you tell me what palliative care is and how it differs from other forms of medical care?
Well, thank you. I think it's a really important starting point, really, because I think it is often misunderstood what palliative care is. So in a nutshell of a great big specialty, our kind of focus is around improving the quality of life for people who have life-limiting illnesses, whatever that may be. So when I say kind of improving quality of life, we may be looking at the physical symptoms that people may have, but also kind of the social side of their care, and psychological care as well, and trying to allow people to live as well as they can until they die. Some people think it's about a focus on the very end of life and kind of that patients who are dying, but we look after people for a long period of time. I think there's often the thought that kind of what life limiting might mean. And so palliative care, we look after people who have an illness that will shorten their life and that they may die from, but we might actually care for them for a very long period of time.
I think that probably is the greatest misconception, isn't it? When people say palliative care, you think this is really it. This is the end for you as a patient or for your loved one. And it really is not that. And it's also, I guess, often associated. I mean, when I trained as a nurse and practiced as a nurse, it tended to be for patients with cancer. And I guess that's another misconception. Are they, you know, what are the misconceptions that are out there about palliative care and, you know, the lack of understanding about it?
Yeah, and I think that is a big one about the kind of the scope of what palliative care is. And it was kind of historically, it kind of originated from cancer services and meeting the needs of people with cancer and terminal cancer. But actually a massive part of our role, certainly here at Bradford, but nationally as well, is around patients who don't have a cancer diagnosis. So I mentioned we use the term life limiting now because that's a really important term to kind of acknowledge some of the other illnesses that we see a lot of here. So end-stage renal failure, respiratory illness, cardiac disease, frailty in itself, or people with dementia. These are illnesses that maybe didn't quite hit into the palliative care services previously, but really we can make a big impact on improving the quality of life for these people who have illnesses that they may die from. That is a very big misconception.
So that's a very broad spectrum now of patients who might need and benefit from your care. So when you encounter patients under that scenario, what will you do with them and for them?
So, I mean, we've only really spoken about patients so far, but a big part of our role is about families. Yes. As well. And we talk about families, we actually tend to try and use the term those important to them, recognising that actually there's a big unit, a big circle around a patient that is affected by their illness. So we, as well as kind of managing physical symptoms that people may have, we want to look at caring for them as a human being fundamentally. So what it is and who it is that's around that patient that really matters to them. And often when we ask patients about what's important to them, it's not necessarily about some of those physical things that we focus on in hospital. It can be about much wider things around who they care for, their finances, their social situation.
Some very practical help and advice around what the future might hold and how they can navigate all of that and feel supported and confident. Jamila, how do you set about explaining palliative care to patients and their families, especially those who might have cultural or personal reservations?
I think the main thing here is that it's universal. So it's really important that we don't think people from certain groups or certain communities are more worried about palliative care, because that stops us educating in the same way. We're all human beings, and facing the end of our life is really scary for all of us. It's a natural instinct. It allows us to survive. And so people are afraid of what that might mean for them. And we have the specialist skills and the team to help them navigate that.
And what unique challenges do you face in your clinical practice then when it comes to establishing those relationships? And then, and I guess a lot of that is trust-based, and then proceeding for however long that relationship lasts with that patient and their family. What specific sort of challenges might you encounter?
I think, so this is one of my kind of academic interests, understanding mistrust and what trust is. And I think sometimes we think of trust as, oh, we need to gain that person's trust, rather than going, well, what is trust? It's relational, it's human, we're all human beings. And we have an instinctive ability to see if someone is trustworthy or not. And if you've faced a lot of untrustworthy situations, that risk and that kind of triggering of I'm at risk is much higher. And I think the challenges to addressing that is first and foremost us recognizing that reframing that mistrust to actually those individuals are scared. Often families where we think there is mistrust, it's around I want the best for my loved ones, and I'm really worried that you're not doing the best of them, and listening to them and honouring that and understanding, even with palliative care, a lot of how our services are set up are not culturally diverse, and there is different ways of doing this. And what I find is working on ourselves and our barriers to listening and really honouring that mistrust and really genuinely thinking, how can I bridge that gap? And our team are amazing at doing that. I hear it almost week in, week out in our MDT of, it wasn't the right time to have that discussion, Jamila. I'm going to go and meet them another few times, just chat to them, build that trust. And that's because they genuinely want to build that trust. And it's amazing how a few conversations where you're listening, you're relating, you're honouring what's happened before can shift you considerably going forward.
I guess there may be times when, because you are helping to support the family unit, or if it's not the family, the people, Victoria, as you've said, the people that matter most to you. Do you ever encounter a scenario where what the patient wants is different to what the family and that unit around them want? How do you deal with that?
I think, again, yeah, we do come across that quite common. And again, it's just, where has that come from? Where is that coming from? And noting that the vast majority of people, someone who's dying, it's a loved one, they care for them. It's not often. There are certain circumstances where it might be actually a difference and they're not actually advocating for them. But in the vast majority of cases, it's out of love, and it's hearing that backstory, honouring it, and building that trust and bringing those two perspectives. Ultimately, we have to bring the patient first. But what I think our team does that's brilliant is we don't just focus on the patient. We understand their interaction with their family and their community is fundamental. So as just saying, well, this is what the patient wants, we've got to ignore everything else, does a disservice actually to that patient, because they care about what's happening in their family and their perspectives. And that's one of the things I love about palliative care is it is about the family, it is about the wider community, it is about those relationships, and really focusing on that can make a huge difference.
So let me ask some questions now about what drove you to choose the field of palliative care. Can you tell me, Victoria, about your journey into this particular specialty? What inspired you to choose this very challenging, very demanding, very emotionally demanding field?
I mean, my answer here might make me sound very singular, but I, on my first day as a student nurse encountered a patient that actually made me think, this is what I need to do for the rest of my career. That person inspired me to try and make a difference into the quality of patients' care. And so it was somebody who, at the time, I couldn't understand why their care didn't seem good, for want of a better phrase. And it was somebody who was in an acute hospital, dying in a main bay, very symptomatic, all the things that we try and not to have happen was happening to them. And I couldn't quite understand what was wrong and what I needed to improve. But all I could see, there was something that made me think, that's kind of what I need to do. And as much as I think it's a misconception about palliative care that, yes, it is challenging at times and there is lots of emotive situations we get involved with, but I find it actually very uplifting specialty to work in. Like the ability to improve somebody's quality of life and the life of the people that live on beyond them, I find it very uplifting. So from there, from my first day as a student nurse, carried on, worked in haematology, oncology, and then worked in the community as a specialist nurse.
And Jamila, can you share a bit more about your upbringing? Why did you choose medicine? Why did you choose this field of medicine?
To be honest, I didn't want to do medicine. I guess my background, so both my parents are Pakistani. They grew up in Pakistan. They came over in their early teens. We grew up in not far from Bradford in quite a deprived community where girls weren't expected to even finish school as girls. We were just expected to get married. And I was fortunate that I loved maths. I just loved maths. And my maths teacher, just before my GCSEs, fought for me to go from the lower sets to the higher sets. And he really had to fight hard. And that was fortunate for me because, you know, as if to get straight A's at the school. I wasn't expected to get that. It was quite a surprise. So all through med school, I really wasn't sure because, like, I was just like, I really can't do this job. But I did my house jobs in Airedale and then Bradford. And just the first day I went on the ward, I just loved it. And I still love it now. Like, my clinical days are my most favourite days. And I just, you know, it's the decision makings, working with teams, helping people, meeting people of all walks of life. And I guess I kind of wanted to do acute medicine. So I did MAU, A&E here, did loads of acute stuff. And then towards the end of my core medical training, I just thought the thing about palliative care was that it required more than medicine. It was about the other aspects of me, about the humanity, the kind of seeing people as broader people. And I try to not call it palliative medicine. I call it palliative care because it's about the care. It's not about the medicine. We as doctors should be a very small part of it, because actually supporting people at that time of life is much broader than the medicine, although the medicine is important. And that's why I did it. And yeah, I absolutely love it.
So what other personal experiences have really influenced how you approach the delivery of that care?
I guess from my background, and it's taken me a lot, you know, post-COVID, I really started to think about inequalities in a way that was very different to what I'd ever thought of before, because I kind of just got my head down in med school and through my training, just trying to do my best. And we didn't really talk about inequalities in my training. And COVID really opened my eyes to that. And I've had to work really hard to recognize that I had internalized some prejudice against people like me and people from more deprived backgrounds. And it just really made me show that actually we do have issues around that in healthcare. And we really need to work hard to address them, even those of us from those backgrounds. And now most of my work and most of my research is around how do we make sure we value all human beings equally so we can address these deep-seated inequalities. So I think my personal background now really shapes kind of the questions I ask as an academic, but also the questions I ask of my team too.
COVID certainly brought that into much sharper focus, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who's worked in the NHS for 37 years now, I've never spoken as much about inequalities as I have in the last 5 years, probably. A little bit before then, with the idea of the creation of ICBs and STPs and all these sort of three-letter acronyms that nobody quite understands, but the context in which that approach developed was understanding the wider implications and impacts of the environment, of people's education, of where they live, their upbringing, and the manifestation of all of that in acute illness or chronic illness, and how if you make some tweaks at the beginning, you maybe won't get some of the chronic ill health that we do see so much of here in Bradford.
Yeah, and I think that's why I had kind of like a consultant post earmarked at York. I'd come back and COVID just changed me, and that's why I came to Bradford, because I was like, as one of the very few Pakistani consultants in palliative care in the country, I was like, I absolutely need to work somewhere like this. And it's, I think if there's a place that can address this stuff, Bradford has all the assets to do that.
Yeah. So we're going to come on and talk about something that is very dear to your heart. But Victoria, you said that you've also worked in the university and had an academic life. So from your perspective, what role does research play in improving palliative care practice?
I think it's vital. I think from a palliative care, I sometimes struggled in the past. I'm going to say in the past because I do think it's changing with the evidence base and the research behind that, because there's been a kind of a sense that doing research with people who have a palliative diagnosis or who are at the end of their life can feel difficult. And I think what we can't do is kind of gatekeep those people's experiences to improve care. So I think it's absolutely vital that we're doing research within palliative care and we're providing a really strong evidence base for the care that we do. Because I think we're also doing a disservice to the patients we care for by not representing their stories and their experience within it to drive care. You mentioned before about the understanding who that person is that we're caring for and all the factors that may influence kind of how they experience care. And I'm still doing my PhD at the moment. I'm not sure I can say I'm a qualitative researcher, but I very much think I'm interested in people's lived experience and the impact that that has on how they access care, how they interact with the healthcare team, how nurses can interact with them as well and provide and plan that care. So I think understanding the humans, it goes back to that question of who are you, what do I need to know about you to care for you? Yeah. Knowing the humans that we're caring for is really important, and without doing research into that, we can't know that, and we're not doing the right thing for us.
So from that body of evidence then, what changes in your personal practice have come as a result of that, of knowing something that you didn't know before?
Oh gosh, that's every day. I think we're quite I think as a team we're very kind of inquisitive, and if we don't know something we'll always go and try and find an answer. I think every day there's something new that we're learning. I think, and Jamila, you hinted at it earlier on talking about the MDT, that's something that we do within our multidisciplinary team meetings, is try and understand the evidence behind something, but actually then try and understand the human factors within that. So why is it, what is it about this group of patients or this disease that's meaning we're seeing this as an outcome? And I think we're just inquisitive.
So Jamila, this is clearly a passion of yours, and you've somehow are managing to balance the kind of demands of clinical practice with your passion around research and make this perfect sort of harmonization of the two somehow. I'm sure you probably feel like you're doing two full-time jobs most of the time at least. Can you elaborate on your current research projects then, and what's their objectives?
As my clinical practice shows me, one of the greatest challenges we have in palliative care is inequalities in access to our care, inequalities in the quality of that care when people come into palliative care, and the outcome. So we know people from ethnic minority groups, people who are poorer, people with disabilities, people from the LGBTQ+ communities, they all have less access to palliative care, poorer experiences and poorer outcomes. And that's a national thing. And we've done really well in terms of ethnic minority and people from deprived backgrounds in Bradford, but we've still got a long way to go. And that's where my research has focused. So one of the projects we're doing is looking at our data that we've got across Bradford, linking primary care with hospital data, with social care data, with hospice data, to really understand those inequalities and map them out and look at the intersection. So not just ethnic minority groups, but how does ethnic minority group with gender interact? How does it interact with coming from different socioeconomic backgrounds? We're doing another project looking at how we can best use people from the community to do research. So for them to develop the questions, for them to go out and collect the data, and for them to analyze it. So they are generating the knowledge because they are the ones who are, as Victoria says, their lived experience should shape the questions
we ask. How easy or difficult is it to engage with communities on this subject matter? Do you find that people, is it difficult at first and then they are interested? I don't know. My sort of preconceived ideas about all this is sometimes people don't want to talk about palliative care because of their association with it being about the end of life. And it's one of those, it's a bit like put your head in the sand, don't talk about it, it won't happen.
So I'll give you one example. So one of the projects we did that was funded by Hospice UK, so a national charity, was to work with Women's Zone. And I just approached them and said, look, I'm a palliative care consultant. This is me. Told them my background, my history, why I've come to Bradford. And we did a series of workshops with the women. And actually what we found was it's not difficult. People want to talk about death and dying. It affects everyone. Either you've lost someone, we're all going to die, or, you know, it is everywhere. And one of the things that came out of that was, so the first session we did, there was a lot of distress, obviously. These women come together every week and they've shared stuff around mental health, around kind of poverty, a lot of work, but they hadn't done death and dying. And the leads were like, oh my God, what is happening? There's so much. But I was like, we just need to create this space. And then over the course, we used a local artist to do these workshops. By the end of it, they were like, wow, I can't believe we had never discussed this. This was like, I sit next to her every week and I never knew her grandson died in that way. And it impacted her and it still impacts her, such that we've now created a monthly kind of community, just a space for them to come together as a bereavement support group for each other and to create space, which we're working with Marie Curie with. And actually we've gone on to get more funding because they were like, we want more, please. We want to do more around this area. So again, I think it is a misconception. I think people do want to, it's how we create that safe space, that contained space for them to engage in it.
I guess it's not, I don't imagine it's like a taboo. It wasn't a taboo, but much like, you know, some of the more high profile campaigns around talking about mental health, you know, it's okay not to be okay. And then talking about men's mental health. Do you find that there is a difference between people's propensity to open up and engage between sort of genders or other characteristics?
So we do know from national evidence that men are less likely to access palliative care services if you just purely look at gender and you don't look at the intersections between ethnic minority groups. And that tends to be because there is perhaps a greater reluctance, but also they tend to maybe die of unexpected events around suicide as well. So again, I would frame it as we need a different approach. It's not that they're reluctant, it's that we haven't figured out the right approach to make it safe for them to do that and stuff. There are now initiatives like Men's Sheds, et cetera, where people have created, they've just thought differently.
The space to open up about anything.
Yeah, really. Exactly. So it's just different approaches for different groups. Yeah.
I think it goes back to us sometimes gatekeeping that experience and actually saying that that isn't us as clinicians or academics or kind of in our role saying that isn't something that people want to talk about. That's a really difficult topic. We're gatekeeping that away from them. And actually the evidence is saying people do want to talk. People do want to have their voice heard. And I think that's something that we should really take on board as healthcare professionals.
We're sort of sitting here today. This podcast will be broadcast a little bit later on. But Rob Burrows, his death, do you find that sort of sentinel events that are more publicly understood and known about and quite high profile will give rise to more sort of interest in those areas and might kind of spark conversations?
Yeah, we were literally just talking about this as a team over lunch, and kind of reflecting on some of our feelings about Rob Burrows' death and kind of what that means. Because, you know, I think locally it gets people talking, but because of that very close link people have from the rhinos, but actually it's a national conversation. And I think that is one of the legacies, as well as this wonderful unit that's coming in Leeds with the breaking of the ground yesterday. But actually it's getting people talking about some of these illnesses. And I think when people die young, as he was, it gets people talking about their own thoughts and wishes for the future, I think. And I kind of, from reading and hearing him talk, I think that would be a legacy that he'd absolutely want us to talk about death and dying and the future.
And I guess the other thing that comes to my mind is, so we're doing this project with three community researchers. There's three Pakistani women from deprived backgrounds in Bradford who have been trained to do research, who have gone to find women who are really on the margins of the margin, never been involved in research, to get their experiences. And they've come back with such useful evidence. But one of the things that's been really important as we've had our meetings is what's going on in Palestine. And actually that has instigated a lot of discussions around death, dying, grief, collective grief. Yes, yeah. And that's kind of with Rob Burrows. So again, for different communities, different things, and different recognizing events. Us honouring it in our meetings and making space for that discussion had such a big impact on our community researchers. They were like, I've gone to other meetings where I've had to hold it back because people, not because they're being mean, they just don't recognise it's such a big thing, but because you're from the community, you know, just making that space makes a big, big, big difference. And again, I think people do want to talk about it.
They do, and the exposure and the accessibility of the images and the stories, and it's certainly not avoidable, even if you wanted to avoid it. And so better to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Jamila, we've talked about your two passions. How do you manage to juggle them both then?
Ask my husband. Well, I think that's a big thing, to be honest. This is my big learning curve now. Like I say, I never saw myself as an academic. I saw myself as a clinician, but the research aspect is definitely growing, and I'm in a privileged position to make a difference in Bradford. That's the only reason I do it. But I do need to be balanced with it. I've got two young children, but also another real passion of mine is diversifying the people who do research. So we need more nurses like Victoria to do, you know, we need our OT. We need our physios, we need our health cares, we need different people, because different people will see different things and they will bring different questions, but all fundamentally really important. So for me, if we only have a certain group of people who have to be quite privileged to be able to work at a certain level, then we're not going to ask the diverse questions we want. So I see it as a really important role of mine to demonstrate that you can do both in a balanced way, and different people can do it in different ways. Otherwise, we really do risk what we have at the moment, which is a very small demographic who kind of are the professors across the UK, across Bradford, who get to ask the questions. I think finding different ways to do it is really important.
And I think the point that you made, Jamila, about if we're going to do this and do it really well for the communities that are as diverse as those that we serve, then we're better to do it in Bradford, have that diversity within our clinical teams, within everybody who works in this organisation, that are representing the people out there and can relate and share the lived experiences of those individuals. That's really important, is it? As a clinician, I think that ability to share something in common with people. So what are your longer term aspirations then? That's probably a bit of it, more people in the team, more influence, more impact for the team because of that. I know you're not going to leave this interview without saying more investment, Mel. That's what we need.
I think I've been reflecting on this a lot as my workload, and because I've got a few big grants now, which means I am going to do more time doing research, and kind of thinking, oh, but I love the clinical, where am I going with this? And what I've settled on at the moment is all I care about is making a difference on the ground. So whatever it takes, research is a part of that. My clinical work is a part of that. Affecting policy and influencing policymakers is also a big part of that. And so as long as I keep that clear in my head, a bit like when I had that clarity, is absolutely, it's got to be palliative care because I want something more than medicine. I think it's really clear to me. And this is what, again, John Wright at the Bradford Institute, what really made me passionate about coming to work here in Bradford, is the first question he asked me was, why do you want to do research? And if it's not to make a difference, Bradford isn't the place for you. And that's what's brilliant about the academics in Bradford, the people who come to work in Bradford. I think we're all dedicated to making a difference to our communities. And as long as we keep that, whatever it takes to do that, then, you know, things will change through the NHS. Change is just what's going to happen. And and our team have just got to keep our eye on that.
And Victoria, it sounds like for you, there's certainly a completion of a PhD in the pipeline.
Hopefully. That's the big focus at the moment. That's taking up a lot of time. I suppose it goes back to what you were saying, Jim, about varying the research within healthcare and the people that do it. So I feel really strongly about kind of amplifying nurses' voices and amplifying nurses' voices within research. So I think sometimes, or certainly I saw kind of earlier on in my career, that wasn't something that nurses could do, or certainly wasn't something that I could do. And then as I became more experienced, I realised that actually I was no less skilled or intelligent or inquisitive than any of these other people who were doing it. Encouraging other people who were me a little while ago to also go down that path, that actually we do, as nurses, we're asking important questions, and actually then having the ability to do something with that question, to do something with that inquisitiveness is really important. So I would really like, I don't know if inspire is the right word or too strong a word.
I think it is.
I'd like to inspire other people to take that journey as well. I think it's really important that as nurses we have that voice.
And you're two fantastic role models in that regard. Some fantastic stats came out. I think last week I've seen articles by John Wright from the Bradford Institute highlighting that I think it was Bradford amongst the highest patient recruitment for trials, research, all of those things anywhere in the country, it looks like, which is some feat, isn't it? You know, people... we're not good at blowing our own trumpet oftentimes in Bradford. And that really is some kind of demonstration of the commitment of people like John, people like you, Jamila, and Victoria, to see the value of asking the right questions, doing the research, and translating that into making a difference. How can patients and their families and members of the community get involved in your research if they want to?
So there's a multitude of ways of getting involved in research across Bradford. So we have obviously got the Born in Bradford cohort study, which gets people right from the moment they're born. And there's work with the Improvement Academy that's doing loads in the hospital across how do we improve care. There's people like us working in end-of-life care. So actually one of the big studies that we'll be starting next year that I'll be leading is around the issue of racism and discrimination at the end of life. It's going to be Bradford focused. And again, across the community, I did not have to work hard to get people were asking me to do this. Loads of different community groups are going to be involved. It's going to be co-produced. It's going to be about bringing people across our healthcare system together to think about how we can address this really important issue. But again, I think Bradford has all the assets to address it. I think it is absolutely, if you're interested in research, there's many ways to get involved. And actually the NIHR, the National Institute of Health Research, has a website where you can look at how, as a member of the public, you can get involved in research.
I think it's sometimes about, we can sometimes think about all the studies as well, but then it's all the ways that we get information that we sometimes don't see as research that can actually be research. So at the moment, we've got the National Audit of Care at End of Life. That's a year-long national audit that we're doing, which has a lot of information and data that we'll have that can improve patient care at the end of it. So we're looking at case notes. We've got a staff survey around kind of confidence in providing care at end of life. I can encourage anybody to complete that. Or
I filled it in.
You have filled it in.
2 years on the run, yes.
I don't want to say that we had a competition about who could get to you first, but we did. But staff can fill that in. And that's been involved in research and data and audit and numbers.
And sometimes the word research is, it's too... I don't know, unreachable.
It feels ivory towerish,
people,
doesn't
it? Mm-hmm. If you say, do you want to be involved in some research? And people, well, no, I don't think so. But if you say, would you be prepared to have a chat about your experiences and what it has been like for you and what you needed and wanted? They'd say, absolutely.
Yeah. It's information to help improve patient care ultimately. And that's kind of how I see it. And we get that from lots of different avenues and people can be involved in it in lots of different ways as well.
Well, huge thank you to you, Victoria and Jamila, for sharing your insights and your experience with us today. And if you want to learn more about palliative care, just head to our website and search for palliative care, and you can see all the amazing work that Jamila, Victoria and the team are involved in to try and make a difference.